Accession number 11522, Reel 3.
Dennis Allen, Reel 3. Yes, you're now going to tell me about your release.
Yes.
Was there a procedure for this?
The day before you're due to go, you go before the governor and a little panel of people, including somebody from the DPA, as it then was, the Discharged Prisoners Aid Association. And I must admit, I was a bit struck by the very cursory inquiry as to one's potential well-being after leaving prison. Simply that. The DPA representative seemed to be simply part of the machine. And, of course, one can't complain. I don't want to make an issue of it, really, because there was a war on. Everybody was up to their eyes and this, that and the other. But after the war, when I had contact with the prison service and so on, I have to say I found similar attitudes prevailing about prisoners released from prison, and it's just that kind of continuation of something which was very understandable in wartime into the post-war period, which was a bit disappointing.
So your actual release, you know...
Actual release, 8 o'clock in the following morning, out I go, and off I go to my girlfriend's flat, the one who had left her job in Bristol and was working at the corner house. And she put me up, and I, of course, had no money. The DPA hadn't thought necessary to give me anything when I left prison. And what in the early time, she used to go off early in the morning to do breakfasts at the corner house, and I would arrive there, and she would bring me. I'd sit at her one of her tables, and she'd bring me my breakfast, and under the plate, instead of me leaving the tip for her, she'd leave me the money to pay the bill as I went out. And that was very heartwarming. Yes, and so then after that, that was the end of that prison experience.
You know, after this prison sentence, I wonder what your status would have been. Having had a summons and then gone to
yes,
prison.
You see, there were various things. I had three offers of work, of the kind of thing I wanted to do, I thought, when I came out of prison that first time. And the one I chose to do was to join with a pacifist service unit working under the railway arches at Charing Cross in a shelter for people who could not be admitted to ordinary public area shelters. They were verminous, they were alcoholic, they were whatever, some diseased, and could no longer sleep on the embankment and in the public squares and all the rest. So we ran this shelter for the remainder of the war, in fact, it was run. I didn't stay all that time. But that was a great learning experience for me, of course. We used to do 12-hour shifts, day or night, for £1 a week. Of course, it was in essence a voluntary effort. All you got was your maintenance. And subsequently, my wife, who was working in a rest centre by then, as a kind of welfare person, she came and joined us. And she, they were living in one room behind St. Martin in the Fields Church, 12 people, and there were 6 beds in that room. And the day shift got out of bed as the night shift came into bed. And that's how they were living, almost like the tramps and such under the arches. And we thought, really, something should be done about that. So we found a 4-room flat, and my wife and I had one room to ourselves in that, and she kind of mothered the unit a bit, and...
Were you married then?
Yes, we had married by then. Mm. We were married at the Friends Meeting House. So I learnt an awful lot from people, such a variety of people, intelligent people who had deliberately chosen a disassociated life. One who was known as the professor, his name was indeed Joad, and he would echo Professor Joad on the Brain Trust, who used to say, depends what you mean by this chap, much the same. And others. There was a sailor who had sailed, as he said, before the mast around Cape Horn, I don't know how many times and so on, and who taught me to play crib, which was a very good sailor's game. And others. And then there were the psychopaths who would come and threaten all sorts of mayhem if you didn't give them this, that or the other. And that was a good test for one's pacifism, actually. It was a good practical experience. I remember one chap coming in and demanding clothing from our clothing store. And it's funny, actually. One might be a little frightened by that kind of experience, but and a woman could very well be more frightened because of physical force. But in fact, I used to almost enjoy the challenge of that. He would threaten and say, I could wipe the floor with you. Of course you could. Look at the size of you. Of course you could. But what good would it do in the end? You'd take some clothes now, but next week you'd be back for more. So what's the point? This kind of thing. And it was very interesting, actually, to see in action how pacifism could deflect conflict. So I learned a lot there. It was a good experience.
Were you ever assaulted by these people?
Never. I've been threatened with assault subsequently, you know, in similar kind of social work situations which I've been in. And as I say, I distinguish between somebody like me who is 5'10" and reasonably physical, and a woman facing a big man who could easily do her heavy, heavy damage. So I don't like to theorise too much from that experience. But I think there are lessons to be learned about how to diminish aggression and deflect conflict through practice, not just through theory.
But if pushed, and that's the wrong word, I think, but if you know, you really had to, would you use force against anyone?
No, I had concluded I wouldn't. But, well, no, I'm sorry, I've answered you too firmly. If the violence was directed at me during my time at that shelter under the arches, I concluded I must never respond and retaliate. The question always arises, if somebody was threatening your wife, then it becomes a different matter. And I simply can't answer saying, no, I wouldn't intervene. So that's the, and that's the traditional question that's always asked of conscientious objectors in tribunals, of course. So,
is talking of tribunals, what was happening to you regarding the authorities? You know, had they left you alone at this time?
For a while, yes. I mean, they knew that I was out, and that the time came when they thought it was, they'd better have another look at me. And after I'd been, I suppose, I don't know, perhaps 12 months working under the arches, I was in court again and sentenced 6 months. Which was spent at Wormwood Scrubs, which was a different thing. But it was no shock, of course, having had it before, and several of my friends were already there.
How did the Scrubs compare with Wandsworth?
Well, The Blitz was no longer on. It was more civilised and more organised, therefore. And I was early on made a red band, so-called. You know, this is a prisoner who can wander around the prison without being permanently supervised. And physically, it was better. In Wandsworth, one just looked out onto a yard. At Wormwood Scrubs, I used to stand on my chair and look for hours across the scrubs. There was it was April to June I was there, and there was a marvellous bed of irises, a long, long bed in front of the prison wall, which the garden work party used to maintain. And beyond that was the scrubs, and beyond that there was the Great Western Railway line from Paddington with its trains, with their cream and chocolate livery streaming off to the west, you know. And so you could imagine him get taken away to these places, Malvern or Carmarthen or, you know, whatever. And I spent a lot of time just daydreaming, looking out of the window. But, of course, also being a Red Band, I had other opportunities. This is the most extraordinary thing, which you won't really believe. The job I was given as a Red Band was to be the chief officer's cleaner, which meant that for half an hour in the morning while he was at breakfast, I went to his office, which was part of the administration of the prison, and cleaned his office while he was out. And when he came back, I had to disappear. And I was given the job, and I still don't believe it, I was given the job of filing the records of all prisoners who were discharged. Now, so I had access to the whole of the filing system in Wormwood Scrubs Prison. That is quite astonishing and incredible. But the extraordinary coincidence, this just gets worse and worse, I must tell you. Before getting into Wormwood Scrubs this time, I had been studying at what is now the Portman Clinic, and what in those days was the Institute for the Institute for the Scientific Treatment of Delinquency. It became the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Delinquency, and later the Portman Clinic. And I was doing an external London diploma in social studies. And the course I was taking was the psychology of delinquency at that time. And here I was in Wormwood Scrubs prison with access to all the prisoners' records. I mean, it was an extraordinary series of coincidences and incredible negligence, it seemed to me. And I thought of all the other people who had had my job before and who would have it after I left, and what use they could possibly make of what information they gleaned about offenders. I'm sure that doesn't prevail now, and it may have been simply in wartime there weren't the staff to do it and so on, and nothing really mattered much about prisoners or I don't know what. It was a very amusing, the whole thing was an incredibly amusing episode. As I say, I'd been taking this course, and unfortunately the date of the exam fell in the middle of my prison sentence. And the Quaker minister came to visit me, and I asked him to try and get me permission to take this exam in the prison. And that went on day after day, and no answer. And so on 5 days before the date was due, I was given permission. I had to write 3 essays to qualify to take it in those 5 days. And only then was I allowed my books. So I did it. And came the day of the exam, and the deputy governor himself came and said, well, look, I'm invigilating. Have a good time. I hope it goes well. Here's the exam papers. And I said, well, look, you realise I've got my books in here. Wouldn't it be wise to take me somewhere else? So the deputy governor then took me down to an unoccupied cell on the ground floor, detailed a prison officer to keep an eye on me, locked me up and with the exam paper. And it caused so much interest that this guy taking this exam, especially given the subject. The prison officer was a very nice, friendly man. He kept on opening the door. How's it going? And then offering me a cigarette. Well, of course, I'd not been able to smoke. I'd not been allowed to smoke. And for fear of offending him, I accepted the cigarette and started smoking the thing. That made me feel very strange. So it was... and then all the prisoners came. At 12 o'clock came, and they all came in for their lunch, and the clanging and the... Well, you can imagine, it was bedlam. But hilarious bedlam. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I did indeed even pass the exam. So, Wormwood Scrubs was kind of... Oh, it was epic for me in a way. It was a very funny experience. And it was generally very friendly.
Did you think you gained from those two prison experiences?
Oh, enormously. I mean, the first thing I gained was the knowledge that when I sit on a bus there next to me. There's a 1 in 10 chance that this chap came out of prison last week. He's normal. He looks like me. He behaves like me. He's now basically different. And so through that, the prisoners aren't a different breed, because I call prisoners off, because I had that one experience. The number of people, of British people in this country, who've been through the prison system is legion. So to adopt a kind of them and us attitude is irrelevant, apart from it being lacking sufficient humility, because for many people they should be in prison and would have been had they been caught or whatever, or had they committed the kind of offence that acquires prison sentence, instead of the kind of offence that just upsets the family or you know, leads to divorce or all these other social things that one does in one's life, and which in my view are just as wicked as stealing some property. So that, I mean, that it reoriented me entirely about the prison system. I think I was sympathetic to being reoriented, but it had that effect.
As you've already said, you know, the effects on your work, you know, in the social sphere.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
The fact that you employed an ex-prisoner.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean,
Has it ever done you any harm, though, in your career, do you think? You know, the fact that you have been in prison, well, has it been held against you?
Well, the only time it was held against me was very much my benefit, because I told you when I left school I went and worked in an office where I was sacked after the war had started because I was a conscientious objector. Not because I'd been in prison, but I was tied up. And that was the best thing that happened to me. I'd already, as I told you about the refugees, I'd already been looking in other directions. I was clear I couldn't stay doing what I was doing. So it just gave me the push I needed. But I can't remember any other episode where prison experience has been a handicap. Well, yes, I mean, this is strange. Some years later, in the early 1960s, I was invited to be... Oh, it happened twice. I'll deal with the second one first. I was invited to be the Quaker minister at Winchester Prison, where I was living, and I said, yes, I would be glad to. And I saw the governor and so on, and the chief probation officer there and so on, and they were happy I should do it. And I told them about my background. They said, fine, it makes no difference to us. We'd better just tell the Home Office. And, of course, in due course, the Home Office said, no, we can't have this chap as a Quaker minister. Now, earlier, in, I think, 1951 or two, possibly three, I had applied to join the Prison and Board Civil Service as an assistant governor class two or whatever it is. And I had an interview with the board, which had seemed to go quite well, and subsequently, a few weeks later, I'd heard on the grapevine, pack your bags, get ready, you've been accepted. And nothing happened, and nothing happened. So in the end, I asked Fenner Brockway, the MP, actually, if he could find out what was causing the delay. And he wrote to the then Home Secretary about it, who replied, I have personally taken the decision not to employ him because I do not approve of ex-prisoners having responsibility for current prisoners. Now, that struck me, and still does, as an extraordinarily blind assessment of possibilities. I mean, it ignores the experience of other countries, of California and so on, where ex-prisoners have been used with enormous success dealing with youngsters in trouble. And it seems so bureaucratic to eliminate everybody without saying, well, let's have a look at this guy and see whether he's got something, to see whether, in fact, he has got something unique to offer prisoners without compromising the prison system. And I think there are plenty of ex-prisoners who could be employed in that way. So I was very disappointed about that. But then, it shows a total bureaucracy. The prison system was under the immediate management of the Home Office. I then applied to work in what was called an approved school, which these were schools for delinquent kids, but they were run by either local authorities or voluntary organisations, under distant control from the Home Office. So when I applied to this approved school, I again dealt with my experience and I said, I regard this as an additional qualification, I hope you will. And they did. They had to have a Home Office representative on the selection panel, and they had to go into quite a lot of cogitation until in the end the Home Office said, yes, well, let's appoint him. Let's agree to his appointment. So and different right hands and left hands of the Home Office adopted quite different policies. And possibly still do, for all I know, I don't know. But that seemed to me to epitomise the totally inappropriate attitudes that underpin the management of the prison service. Once a prisoner, always a prisoner. Never mind what efforts he makes to rehabilitate himself. And in my case, I don't think anybody really felt I needed rehabilitation. But plenty do, and make immense efforts. And it's so wasteful of human resources. All because people are unwilling to say, there but for the grace of God go I.
So coming out from your second term, what happened about you tribunal-wise? You know, would this have been the time when you had your appeal?
Yes, that's right. By getting a sentence more than 3 months, I was entitled to appeal. And here I must admit to some inconsistency, because I'd refused to register and therefore go to a tribunal in the first place. But having been in twice, I didn't really find prison experience unpleasant, as I've indicated. It wasn't a discomfort to me, and there were plenty of people who I regarded as friends in there with me. But it did seem a bit wasteful, and I was engaged in work outside, which I really valued and wanted to go on doing. So I did then apply to go before a tribunal. In principle, I didn't approve, really for two reasons. Well, for the first one I've already explained to you, the kind of exemption angle of it. But the second one, the question of the capacity of a tribunal to judge whether indeed you were conscientious. I knew a number of inarticulate people who were incredibly sincere in their pacifist beliefs, but couldn't argue the case, and who were not given exemption. And, of course, there was a whole category of people who were excluded, whatever the tribunal might have thought, because they were called Jehovah's Witnesses. And the prison was stacked with Jehovah's Witnesses, the Woman Scrubs especially, by the time I got there. JWs, as they were called, they were down every corridor. And didn't complain, but it was a kind of victimisation which Hitler had been engaged in Germany on Jehovah's Witnesses. I had a rather principled objection to tribunals, and I was still determined that if they gave me exemption, whatever condition they tried to impose, I was going to say, well, look, I'm not going to be prepared to abide by that. But I must say, when I got to a tribunal, it was a very civilised affair. There was a judge in charge of it, with two laymen, one a businessman and one a trade unionist, an employer and a trade union representative. That's the traditional English way of handling these institutions. And we had an interesting discussion of this and that. The judge was excellent and extremely civilised and sensitive. I liked them all. The trade unionist especially, because at one point we'd been going through the examples if a German soldier was going to rape your wife and all the stuff, and we were talking about right and wrong. And I then, at one point, quoted, I think it's Hamlet, anyway, I said it was Hamlet, "Nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." And the trade unionist folded his hands across his chest and said, "It seems to me you think too much, young man." And what are you saying? For heaven's sake, get out there in the army, you know. But he was marvellous, and I really appreciated him. But they gave me exemption. And on condition I continued to do social work. They knew what job I was doing. Well, I said, "Well, thank you for the exemption. As I've told you, I intend doing social work anyway, but I shan't feel bound to do so." And 3 days later, I was let out. But I did appreciate the civilized way that the British do these things, you know. And the great distinction was between the Second World War and the First World War in that respect.
Because the argument which is so often put against the absolutist is that in a situation of total war,
yeah,
no one can really be outside of society.
Absolutely.
You know, everything impinges.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I don't try to defend myself in logic in argument in the end. As I said, this for me was a kind of, I won't say an impulse, but more than an impulse, it was a kind of command which I had felt as a result of prayer. And sometimes prayer leads you beyond logic. I think it is defensible in terms of logic, but there's not an unarguable case about it. And I think the importance, there are certain important things, is one, that you retain your integrity. You're not scheming, you're not being devious, you're not trying to escape this or that. And two, that you have positive goals in mind, that you genuinely believe this is the most constructive way you can help the people of your country and of other countries. You're not doing it for selfish reasons. We all have some selfish motives, but you've got to try to erase those and see it in terms of your social obligations. And I think it's legitimate to see your social obligations in those terms.
How did you regard, say, ARP duties? Did you do any fire watching?
Well, I must say, when I was at Woodbrook, I did that on the Woodbrook property. I used to take my share of sitting up on the roof and so on, and kicking little fire things over the edge and what. I didn't join any organised thing. I wouldn't have joined the Air Raid Precaution Service for the same basic reasons. I felt some slight misgiving about the firebomb thing, but I felt that would have been taking it too far. I was younger, and I was something of an extremist, to the extent that my wife and I had this thing about never even going in an air raid shelter. I mean, it was crazy in a way, but we used to walk home along Lansdowne Road in Notting Hill, in Holland Park, and hear the shrapnel coming down in the bushes in the gardens, and achieve the security of her flat, because we were so stupid, if you will. Yes, certainly stupid, but we were, in a sense, living on another plane. We were very much in love. What became of us didn't much matter. I remember we deliberately went into an air raid shelter when there was no raid on, to see what it was like, just so that we knew what it was like. You all think that's crazy, and I'm sure we were.
And we didn't deserve to survive, I suppose, because other people were protecting us and all the rest. I recognise that.
Did you wear gas masks? Did you carry your gas mask about?
No, but of course that was no big deal, because very few people ever did. They were.
Not even at the beginning of the war, when there was...
I was issued with one and brought it from the issuing centre in Kentish Town to where I was then living, and put it away and never looked at it again.
When you look back now, do you consider that you were extremist in your attitude?
Yes, I certainly was. There's no doubt. But at that age, and faced with the same things again, I think I still would be. And if I weren't now, it might be because I'm now less courageous than I was then. Not because my convictions are all that different. I might. Who knows? In a sense, now, at the age of 70, I've less to lose. So, I honestly don't know what would happen now. I'm still as firmly convinced that positive pacifism, not negative pacifism, is the Christian way of life. And nothing that's happened in the last